outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of Bravada's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Gin.
So it's Father's Day today. Happy Father's Day.
Well, thank you. It's not Father's Day when everybody hears this, but it is for you and I sitting here, Father's Day.
Yes.
So I guess we do this a little bit late for everybody else. But,
yes.
Well, thank you. It's been a joy to be your father.
I know. We actually got to see you today, too, which was nice.
Yeah, you guys came over, and this is the first time I've had somebody actually in the studio
with me.
Yeah, so I'm not alone, but welcome, Julie, my daughter, for those of you who don't know, Julie Williams, and we're back at it to do it again together.
Yes.
And so how much easier would your life have been if your parents hadn't been running drugs up Utah?
Oh.
But it made your life easier?
That's you don't want to hear that kind of phone call.
We didn't call
you. Or you didn't text.
Just texted you. Yeah, Sarah and I went to Denver to visit my son. And somewhere in the plains of Utah, we got pulled over in our rented RV. Sarah was driving.
Poor mom. Like, if someone's got to drive during that, I wouldn't want it to be me.
Yeah, Sarah just handled it great. I mean, because the cop obviously didn't want to talk to me. He wanted to talk to her because she was driving. So he was directing everything at her. So I just kind of let it roll. But yeah, we got pulled over in a rented RV. And it was weird because we're getting these weird kind of questions. But nothing makes sense. You know why I pulled you over? And Sarah's, I don't have a clue. Well, you were kind of moving in your lane, like back and forth. I'm like, okay, we're on a rough road. It's windy.
Yeah,
we're driving an RV.
RV.
There's a little movement, but she's not crossing lines or anything. I'm like, this doesn't make sense. And then it was, you know, give me your license. And then he wanted her to go back so he could run the license. And I'm like, this is all pretty strange because there's nothing even to write a ticket for. I mean,
yeah,
she wasn't swerving in the lane. She wasn't drunk. She wasn't. And then about 20 minutes later, she comes back up, and another cop car pulls up behind.
So you
that
sat
one.
For 20 minutes in the RV.
Yep.
Were you just like, "What is happening?" Like,
I'm trying to figure it out. I'm going, "This just doesn't make any sense to me."
Yeah.
And then when another cop car pulls up, it took me a while to recognize. Another car pulled up behind, and I'm thinking, I'm looking through mirrors way back, and I'm like, and then a guy gets out in uniform, going, "More cops! Wow, this is interesting."
Gosh.
And then Sarah comes back up and says, we got to get out. We got to get the dogs out. And so what's going on? He said, well, it's a major drug thoroughfare. It's where they run drugs up from L.A. up into that part of the world. And they've been using RVs and renting them. So they've got some kind of operation going on. Then I remembered I passed three or four cars getting there when I was driving.
RVs?
That had been pulled over. Not all RVs. Okay. Some were vans, different things. But they had like an operation going.
Right.
And they were looking for an excuse because they had probable cause, I guess. I don't know what all the rules are about them, the lawyer. But anyway, we decided to cooperate.
Good idea.
And honestly, with all the stuff going on racially and all the conversation I've been in, I even had the thought, I'm glad I'm not black or brown because this is a very different reality.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm not nervous. I'm not worried about it. We got no. And then they wanted to sniff the cars. Why they want us to get out with our two dogs, because their two dogs make their dogs nervous. So we had to take our two dogs, walk away from the RV, and then they brought their dog. They didn't go in. They just walked him around, let him sniff everything, and then came back and said, oh, you guys are fine. We kind of knew that already.
Yeah.
We were fine, but yeah. So then we, that's 45 minutes for all that stuff. But I was even thinking, even when you come up and talk to us, because they didn't see it. We didn't drive by a cop and they decided to pull us over. They came up from behind.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't like we'd been profiled in any way. But then when you come up and talk to us, we're two people in our 60s for pizza.
You guys must have looked awfully guilty.
You
and your dogs.
I look back going, this is unbelievable. How could they be taking our time? We're trying to drive 12 hours to get as close to Denver as we can on day one. But yeah, it was a little bit of it was a conversation piece for a while. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yikes.
And then the more you think, and we passed another guy up the road further after those guys went around us. I don't know if it's the same guys or not, because we went by it pretty fast. But there was a kind of a panel van thing pulled over, and there was like three cop cars there, and they were pulling stuff out of the back of the van and stacking it. I'm going, dog must have found something there. We just keep pulling.
Well, you're lucky that, you know, the dog, it's a rental RV, so you never know who had what before you guys got it. You're lucky that was cleaned well.
You got to hope.
You got to think in your head, like, I don't know where this has been.
Well, the way it unfolds, we don't have that much time to think about it. Because all of a sudden you're having to walk the dogs and you're trying to manage all of that. And you got two cops walking with Sarah and I away from our van.
So it's like, wow.
Okay, that's a little weird.
Yeah.
And the one guy's searching the van. And then they're kind of triangulating in a way where they don't surround us. But they on half of them around us. So that if they have to pull guns and shoot, they're not going to have a crossfire with you, I guess. It was all seemed really kind of staged. And they were following protocol of some kind. And yeah, I don't even think they apologized. But it's, hey, we're sorry, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's, okay, you clear. Okay, thank you. That was really fun.
Anyway. What a way to start a trip.
Yeah, to think Sarah has never been pulled over by a police officer in her life.
Yeah.
Ever. And then she's pulled over. I'm like, were you speeding? She goes, and of course we weren't speeding. We had this big vehicle.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We're not speeding. We're well, both of us stayed well under the limit. Not well under, but at the limit.
Yeah.
Oh, anyway, it was kind of crazy. So
can't let you guys leave the state. It's scary.
But we had a great time with our son and his girlfriend at Denver. It was fun seeing him and them and
a puppy.
And they got a new puppy, so we got another.
That was convenient.
We got four grandpuppies and only three grandchildren, so that's not good.
Yeah.
We're kind of behind there. But so anyway, it's good to have you back.
Thank you.
Life going well, the pandemic, quarantining, and
we're at summer break. So
school's finally over.
School is over.
Jesus story's over.
Our dog had to have surgery on two of her back legs, or both her back legs.
Oh, and my gosh.
She's finally doing much better. That's like a 3-month recovery process. So we're finally getting out of the chaos that has been the past, I don't know, too many months and weeks to count. So
Now you look forward to at least a bit of a summer break.
A little bit.
Even though you had a big vacation.
We did vacation. Yeah. And everybody else.
But travel a bit, but that didn't happen. So
yeah.
Actually, Sarah and I are getting out of town again this next week.
I know you are. Can't keep you guys in town these
days. My dad's having surgery, so we thought we'd go up there and help him through that. So it's a minor procedure, but when you're 95,
yeah,
ain't much, it's minor.
Yeah.
So we'll go see, help him feather through that thing.
Well, I think the kids are trying to figure out how to stow away in your car on that one, so you better check for
Shaver Lake kids.
I know.
I'd love to take them.
They know where you're going.
I know. But they'll be up there later in the year. We're going back up later.
Yes.
For a little vacation time. But anyway, I've got a friend named Mark. He lives in the Oregon area. He's been sending me some interesting stories. And then he sent me a question. I thought, you know what? I'll talk about the question with you. But before we do, let's meet Mark a little bit by his story. Mark is a Uber Lyft driver up in the Oregon area. He's had some addiction issues in his past, lost his family because of that, just a wife and kids and some distance there and pain, obviously. He's been through a lot of different jobs, including ministry for a stretch. He was in kind of full-time ministry. Now he's an Uber Lyft driver. And he writes stories. It's kind of like Jesus drives an Uber. It's kind of that kind of a deal. Because he says, the woman got in the car. Hello, she said. Hello, I said back. Some people get gifts from God, tan skin, perfect features, delightful hair, well-formed stuff. Others do not. She was one of the do-nots. She had taken what she had and added bright blue hair with a purple streak running down the middle, various piercings, tattoos, a wardrobe that could only be described as Goodwill on sale. Hey, this stuff is still good and it's only a buck. Noticeable, but not really appealing, at least to me. We all make decisions about people by how they first appear. Bankers and businessmen in custom shirts and suits. Athletes in tight, muscle-rippling t-shirts. Hipsters with their skin-tight jeans and cool shoes. Hospitality people with their tired look and corporate clothes. We all make judgments. Judgments, however, do not transfer into worth, despite what celebrities and our Facebook fame culture tries to squeeze us into. So we began to talk. She was trained to be a nurse, completing her second year, and just getting ready to take her test to become certified, when first her father, then her brother became sick. She was the sole family available, so became the designated caregiver for them both. For the last 2 years, she had cared for them both, giving up her dreams, plans, education, and life to keep them alive. For no money, although she just recently learned the state will step in to help pay her. And she hated them. Not angry, grumbling, furtive looks and bad attitude kind of hatred, the kind of hatred that keeps you up at night, where your gut churns with thoughts of revenge and getting even and the overall unfairness of life and maybe even a way to end their lives so no one would notice. Wow. It's quite an Uber driver conversation here.
Yeah.
The kind of hatred that can send you down the false hope road of drugs and alcohol, which he knows well. Plus, she could have unvolunteered, as it were, and let them go their own way. After all, it was their lifestyles that contributed to their conditions. And I have a right to be happy too, don't I? Don't I? But this blue-haired daughter of heaven stayed at her post. about 6 months ago, in her words, God came down and everything was okay. God? What? And how? A vision? A feeling? But I was crying too hard to voice anything, just enjoying the miracle. And her tears as well, and the real gift from God himself. And let her off at her destination, another story, another ride, another slice of someone's life. This is an incredible job. Isn't that cool? He's written a number of these little goodies. I don't know if he'll put them in a book someday. I said, you might want to. But it's really interesting insights into people. He's the kind of driver, I think, that, you know, if you want to talk, he's ready for it.
Yeah.
If you don't, he'll leave you alone. But interesting story. In fact, they did an article about him up in some newspaper up there just because of his adventure. Anyway, Mark sent me this a while back. He said, would appreciate a discussion around the question of what it is to be a man. Black, brown, white, Christian, non-Christian. That's what he said. I wrote back and said, hey, a little more specificity would be helpful. He said, and he wrote this back. He said, I had a black man as a fair, single dad, blue collar with 12 and 13-year-old boys. We got into a discussion about how to raise a man and a black man in today's society. The conversation went on long after the ride was over. He was very concerned. A great dad. Lots of talk about empowering women. But how do you raise a man? Where are the morals? What is ethical? That could override everything else. I just watched a documentary produced by a woman who got fired from a role in a play by Woody Allen. Her documentary was about people who were fired, stealing, cursing customers and bosses, stealing justified because wages were so low, horrible behavior by those being fired. Burning and looting is now the new norm. Well, I don't know that that's true. We had some people do it, but that's not the new norm. Because of a few incidences by testosterone-riddled law enforcement, we now distrust all police. I wouldn't think that's true either. If we lose that, our cities will be armed camps run by strongmen and their cohorts. Even the mafia had rules which they strictly enforced. I have no idea what it is to be a minority, and especially not a black person. I can never know what that feeling. Racism is real, but rule of law must prevail or we fail. Obama made a speech to that effect. So how do you raise a boy to be a man? And of course, I have much more to say, which cannot be conveyed by email. So that's what Mark left me with. I thought, you know what? I've raised one. You're raising one.
Yeah.
I thought maybe it would be good, friend. We're doing some parenting talk. So welcome. I'm going to invite you into this.
I don't have a whole lot of experience here.
Ah, you're working on it.
We're just getting to those.
Must have good questions, though. Must have good thoughts about it. When do you think, because this is what I think about. Do you think there's more about women empowerment than there is about male morality, as he's alleging in the email? I don't know if that's true, but I'm kind of curious what you see. Do you get more resources for your girls than you do your boy?
I think there's a coming off of the Me Too movement, there's this women empowerment movement that's just naturally kind of, and I'm a woman, so I know about that. I don't search for necessarily resources for them specifically, but
you talk to your girls about that?
Yeah, I mean,
Me Too stuff. And
yeah, I mean, I talk to my kids about, and my girls about, you know, being who they are and talking them through maybe how to be more confident. You know, I have teenagers, so it's a rough age, and they're at different, you know, stages of that. But
an important age. I mean, this is the stuff that's under the focus. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's where those conversations, I think, start. My son is 9, so I don't know. I mean, right now I'm teaching him just to, hey, dude, get the door for, you know, your sisters or your mom. And, you know, just there's a way that I want you to, like, learn to treat a woman at some point. But that's kind of where we've started with him.
That's a little dangerous, too, these days. Getting a door for a lady, there are some ladies that consider it demeaning now. You know that?
Yeah. I don't.
I get it. I don't think most women do. Yeah. I still get doors for women. I hold doors open for men if
I
they're
do
behind
too.
Me. Yeah. So, I mean, it's not just a sexist thing. But that kind of chivalry, I hope we don't lose that. I know some women feel like, oh, that just keeps us captive or feeling like we can't open a door on our own. And it's really not the point. It's really just to be kind.
Polite. Yeah. And I tell my girls, hey, hold the door open. You know, I teach them in some regard the same thing. You know, if there's someone coming out, or hey, get the door for them, you know. So I'm hoping I'm doing the same for the girls. It's just part of being polite. But I do want Austin to learn to, you know, I think you treat a woman different than you treat a man if you're in a relationship with them. So that's important. But I mean, it's hard because he's 9. So I haven't thought big picture, like real going forward.
Yeah, but it made me think about how we might have thought about raising you and Andy. And mm-hmm. did we really do a lot of things differently with you guys because one was male and one was female? And we had different conversations because the needs are different at times. But I don't think there's any morality,
right?
Moral choices we sought to put into Andy that we didn't put into you. I don't know what those would be.
What those would be for my kids either. I'm thinking I'm instilling similar morals in them.
But what do you think were the most important lessons you got from us while you were growing up?
The most important lessons.
Yeah. What do you think about these moral kinds of issues or treating other people, whatever? Do you feel like you got some of them? Do you feel like you got any of that from Sarah and me?
Well, I mean, I think that I did. I mean, I treat people politely and I look out for people. And I think those are things that you're taught, that you learn to, you know, be appreciative, you know, like those are some things that how you treat people, I don't look down on people. I'm pretty accepting of everybody that walks through the door. And so I think you did. I think by, you know, just example, you and Mom were always that way.
Yeah. More than the talk, right? We didn't really have like these moral discussions.
No, we did not.
Here's the rules you're going to live by now.
Because is that effective? Like, I don't know those kinds of things really stick.
That's what I thought when I was reading his email. It really isn't so much of, hey, how do I think of a curriculum I want to instill in a 12 and 13 year old male? Particularly as he's talking to his fare in the car, a black males, that would be any different than what you'd hopefully treat white males, teach them, mm-hmm. and what you teach women, which is, for me, the important things were, you know, be responsible, have some self-initiative, be honest, let your word be your bond. That's one thing my dad mm-hmm. drove into us. If you've said it, even if you don't like what you said, follow through with it. Even if you later go, because there's even a scripture that talks about that. It's who can ascend to the hill of the Lord? He that swears to his own hurt and fulfills it. So I said I would. Now I have more information 6 months later, and now I don't want to. But the thing is, if you're going to be a person of integrity, your word's got to be your bond. So mm-hmm. I see both you and Andy live that well. Mm-hmm. I do. I think you both have a real sense of responsibility, have a real sense of care about other people. And I don't know that we had those conversations. I think you watched us care for a lot of people that came in and out of our home. You guys mm-hmm. were always, I don't know if you were, if you loved it and never told or hated it, and never told us. But I mean, we had a lot of people in our home. We had Sarah's parents living with us for a time that took some energy away from the family, from you kids, because of their needs. And you guys never seemed to resent it.
No.
I mean, I didn't always love it. I'll be honest. I didn't always love the fact that my home was invaded on and there was mm-hmm. nothing we could do about it, that Sarah's time and attention was taken, our time and attention was taken. Mm-hmm. But we made the best of it, I thought.
Yeah.
And I think you both grew up with a real sense of, whether it was schoolwork, whatever, a real sense of responsibility. And
well, there was always like a single person that you'd kind of taken under your wing that was around, and I became close with them. I mean, people stayed with us for a time. And
yep.
So we always had that. I mean, I never thought it was weird. You know, having grandma and grandpa there wasn't weird because they were there for so long. I mean, for as long as I could remember, they were really around. So I think as a kid, you just don't think anything differently of it. And same with like having people in and out of the house, it was just, that's just what we always did. And it was never something that I gave a second thought. And I always enjoyed having others around too. So
yeah. And I watched the way you love people, the number of people in your life, the way you love people, even some of the stories you've told of some difficult people at the school, whatever, that other people are hiding from, and you're extending some love and grace to people that maybe are not the folks normally gravitate to. And I love that. I love the way, I love the expansiveness of both of your guys' friendships with other people. They don't just stay small and inside certain people that benefit me, but they mm-hmm. reach out beyond that. And I think that's awesome. Mm-hmm. We've had some talk recently since you brought up the race issue and the question. I asked Arnita recently, what do you want from us? Speaking, this is one of the Language of Healing Live events. What do you want from the majority community? What really helps resolve this? And her answer was immediate. She just said, I want you to tell Julie that when Austin gets older, not to shoot black people. I'm like, really? That's That even has to be said breaks my heart.
Yeah, absolutely.
But that's the first thing on her mind. And that's seeing all the racial unrest of the last few weeks in our country. This was said before then. This was said before the George Floyd thing. And I thought, wow, that's what moms worry about.
Yeah.
The recent guy that in Atlanta gets woke, mm-hmm. he's drunk, he's in a car. I don't even understand why the first option is for someone to call the cops. My first option is to knock on the window. Hey, are you okay? I think you've fallen asleep.
Yeah.
You know, that would be my first thought. Or if you're behind him in line, honk and wake him up and get moving.
Right.
But, and then they want to handcuff this guy. And if you're a black guy in that age bracket, and you see him panic when they put the handcuffs on, when they try to put the handcuffs on him, it's not really, I'm going to run and it's panic. Mm-hmm. Because I don't know if you cuff me if I get out of this alive. And he doesn't get out of it alive. And they don't cuff him.
Yeah.
Now, you go to that to the mom of those kids. It doesn't matter that they're adults and out of the home. The moms and dads. Man, when you think my child, every encounter in the world is an at-risk moment for my child. Being stopped in a van driving to Denver mm-hmm. is an at-risk moment if I have a different skin color.
Yeah.
And what we've always thought is white people, well, if you just do what you're told and blah, blah, nothing bad's going to happen to you. But that's true in my world. That's not true in their world.
Yeah.
And so where I look at the cops as, oh, man, I'm glad you're here. Things will get better now. We'll get whatever fixed. They look at it as, oh, my gosh, this just went off the rails. There are cops here. And that doesn't mean all cops are bad. I'm a pro-cop guy. I am. But there have been some real racially mm-hmm. broken cops or angry cops or, you know, and those people, I think I'm in the camp that thinks police unions have protected those people too much. Any policeman will tell you, if you know a policeman, ask him, how many people on your police force do you think shouldn't be cops? And the answer I almost always hear is 20 to 25% shouldn't be cops.
Wow.
It means the other 80%, very excellent, conscientious, have the respect of their peers, but there's this 20% that does not. Even the cops know, but the blue wall has been, you can't break it. We've got to back each other no matter what, because they live in a hostile world as targets too. They do. And mm-hmm. so there's no good answers for that. But I think having a respect for humanity and a respect for the law, that's what I try to give you guys. And then you hear all this about the talk that black parents have to give their children if they yeah. have an important engagement with police. And I was telling Sarah, after we got stopped by the cops and we got talking about this driving through Utah, I was going, I got the talk. Said you did. I said, yeah, my dad, when we started driving, dad sat us down and said, you know, when a cop stops you, put your hands on the steering wheel. The same context that black children get it, but
yeah.
just cooperate, go along with what they say. If they're asking you to do something, you do it. Work it out later if they're asking you to do something wrong. But you just show respect to a cop, show deference to a cop. And I remember having that talk. And then Sarah asked me, she said, did you give that talk to our kids? I'm going, hey,
nope.
No, I never did. I didn't grow up in a world that I felt needed it.
Yeah.
And that's what's sad, mm-hmm. that some people do grow up in a world that needs
yeah.
it.
Yeah, it is sad. I can't imagine being a mom and having that, living with that. And I've learned a lot from listening to Arnita. I just love her. And I think what she says has really opened my eyes to some things that I just didn't realize before. And so just even having a small glimpse that I've had from her, it helps to realize, you know, the world we do live in and to get some perspective.
I'm glad we're talking about this more because I've had, you know, Hispanic people and black people in my life, college, very say, we didn't have a lot of black people in this town I grew up in as a kid, but and I have a lot of people I consider friends, but are there people I've ever talked about their racial experiences with? And I'd say not before Arnita mm-hmm. in my own life. And now I do. Now, not just with Arnita, I do with a lot of people. I'll just say, tell me what it's like to have grown up black in America and the part of America. And I've had one guy, black guy, just say, I never faced any discrimination growing up. Okay, you're an outlier. That I know. You're unaware, you're an outlier or something, because everyone else I know has mm-hmm. numerous stories, but they don't mm-hmm. talk about it with us,
yeah.
white people. And you're starting that book, White Fragility, I hear.
I am.
I'm about halfway through it. I can't wait. I mean, we'll have to talk about that here, because I think that's a book that most of my friends won't read, because
really?
They get offended. They'll get mm-hmm. offended really quick. But I didn't get offended, man. I really listened. I'm really listening to what she's saying. And there's things that I think she goes overboard on. But the one thing she talked about is if you grew up white in America, you don't think of yourself as part of a race. You think they're part of a race, whether it's Hispanics, Asians, blacks, whatever. They're dealing with racial issues. You don't think of yourself as a race, and you don't think of yourself having racial issues. Mm-hmm. And just that little thought, oh my gosh, she's right.
Yeah, she's right.
I've not thought about myself as having a race. And we have had, because we settled. I mean, it'd be different if I grew up in Africa, right? But I grew up here. So we settled it. First, we got the inside track on jobs. We had the numbers. We had African Americans enslaved. And we really have never reset the dial on that. I mean, we liberated them from slavery, but we didn't give them equal access to the financial realities of the world we live in. Being able to get a loan, buy a house in a neighborhood. Yeah. And even those things are just kind of getting around to that.
Yeah.
But it's not been fair over the long haul.
And no.
I know you were asking for resources maybe for your kids to explore this because...
Yeah, you know, I really have taken to heart a lot of this stuff. Just, I've been one of those that stopped just to listen and to read and to learn. Because I think that as a mom, like, that's what I owe my kids too. Like, I want them to grow up and have a better understanding of Black people in this country and their history than I had. I've learned a ton the past... I don't even know how long it's been now, 2 weeks or something. I've really learned a lot. I've read a lot, watched a lot, and I found some really great things that I've been just collecting to kind of wanting to explore with my kids over the summer. We're off of school. We're not really taking a vacation. So we have some time, and I think that this is important, and I think they're seeing it on the news as much as I am, and so I think this is the best time to really dive into this with them and educate them as much as it's, you know, I feel like I'm being educated as well. So I have like just some videos and things to sit down and watch with them and kind of have a list so I can pull one up, hoping to like tackle something a week. And, but I want this to just be an ongoing conversation that we've already started. I mean, we've already been talking about it and, but I want them to understand and to not grow up thinking like, I mean, I think I grew up thinking I'm not racist. I'm, you know, I love everybody. And, but I haven't understood what Black people in our country have been through. And I want to understand more.
Yeah, that's good.
So, and I want my kids to understand more. I think that's important.
And I think the challenges here for the white community is how much is that going to change if we take it seriously? I mean, we all want equal opportunity for everybody. Mm-hmm. But if you have 200 years of unequal opportunity, you just say, okay, you can have it now, which is what they want. And yeah, that's great. Mm-hmm. And then it gets into, was it reparations and all people enslaved? So they're all heritage from that. But just the inequities of our culture that has inured to my benefit. The VeggieTales guy wrote an article that I thought was interesting, how I benefited from Black, from social injustice, I think it's something like that. And he tells a story of growing up and his mom got divorced and they ended up moving to this home and he was raised by a single mom. And then one son went to Harvard. One of the brothers went to Harvard. One went somewhere else. He got into film and he tells this whole success story. It looks like, oh my gosh, up from the bootstraps of your feet, whatever. And then he goes back to, well, my mom got divorced, but in the settlement, she got enough to buy a house in Glen Ellyn, Illinois, outside Chicago, where a Black couple couldn't buy a home then. Mm-hmm. And we attended a church that allowed the connections to happen and got the schools that got us into better schools and then the connections that got him into film. Again, he goes back and just says, hey, everything in the deck was stacked to our benefit, even though we came up the hard way, through hard struggles, and we worked hard. And then you think for people that couldn't buy homes, couldn't get loans, couldn't be in there, couldn't start business, couldn't. Mm-hmm. And we keep trying to change the laws about that and way too slowly.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, I just don't know. I still don't. I don't know what it means for us to take on systemic racism. And I still got people, because systemic racism isn't you're a racist. Mm-hmm. It's we live in a culture that punishes certain races.
Yep.
Just by the nature of the way it's built. And I don't think it's all, some of it was definitely overt racism. We want that race held down. Mm-hmm. And some of it is just the corruption of greed. The capitalism, you know, there's things that go on in our world because of capitalism that I don't love. The sexual stuff put in the media because it sells. Some of these decisions weren't necessarily against, I don't think against blacks. I think it was just white was the market they were going for. So whites benefit from it and you hire whites to do whatever, because it's a market thing. And we're not making decisions based on what's morally best, but we're making decisions on what will make us the most money or give us the most political power. I think those aspects of systemic corruption also affect us as a nation. And part of it is the racial thing. And part of it is the greed thing. And part of it is the power thing. It's just people making the best decisions for them without regard for how it's affecting other people.
Yeah.
And if we can, I don't know, I hope that we instilled, and I hope you are too with your kids, a greater moral test. And I know we're so down on absolutes. Everybody's got their own truth and blah, there aren't. And I still am nuts about honesty is a truth, mm-hmm. right? Treating another person like you'd want to be treated is the truth.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Fairness. Not just I want fairness when I'm feeling unfairly treated. I want fairness when I'm being unfairly treated to my benefit. Mm-hmm. I want to find equity. And yet there's not the same passion for equity as there is for fairness when I feel like I'm being cheated. And I think everybody goes through life, feels like they're being cheated. And so everybody's trying to scrawl their way up. And I think that's why whites don't always pause and say, yeah, because the thought is if they'll work just as hard as we'll work, they'll get the same thing. And the effect isn't true. And I'm just freshly wrestling with these things the past 10 years. First started with Luis, my friend, who's from Mexico here. And I see the injustices that his family's, I got close to them. And now with Arnita, and then through the language of healing to a whole lot of other people. And that, I guess we got to instill in kids to answer, how do you do that? I think primarily it's by example. So doing what you said, man, listening and learning for a while, just learning. Mm-hmm. And I'll say this too. I think the greatest enemy of real reform here are the social justice warrior extremists. Just like the conservative white supremacists, they're a barrier to healing. I think the social justice warriors there too. They're asking for things that are just outrageous. They're probably never going to happen. And they do it with a sense that the other side feels like, man, we can't let those people be in control of society. So we're fighting back. And we don't stop enough to say, okay, where's the legitimate concerns here? What is things we can address? And I think it starts by having enough relationships with people who aren't like you so that you don't process their needs the same way you always have, which is just out of, as white fragility talks about, just out of your own whiteness. You can't really understand what the black community goes through. Because if you don't think of yourself as a race and the benefits that you have as that majority dominant race in the culture,
yeah.
you can't wrap your head around what other people are dealing with that's so different from that.
Yeah.
And so the idea is you just work harder. The other thing she talks about a lot is individualism. The individualism allows, because you don't have a sense of community, what's fair in the community. Everybody gets to work hard for what they get. And you can hide your racism underneath this individuality of, if you work hard, you can have what I have. And said, no, you don't have the same opportunity I have. Mm-hmm. You don't have the same resources I have.
You don't start at the same point.
No, not even close.
Yeah.
Don't have the same tools. So, yeah. And then I heard, I was going to play this for you, but I don't know how to get to it right now. So I will finagle this in here. Someone played in this whole pandemic thing, a tape from Elon Musk. And Elon Musk, is the Tesla guy. And he also does some space stuff. He's got SpaceX going. He was talking about the pandemic and how if someone in a hospital dies because of the coronavirus, they get an extra $38,000 from the government than if they die of other causes. But what he says in the recording is that you're paid $38,000 if someone dies of COVID. Your hospital's already financially at tough ends because you've eliminated all the other kinds of care you're giving, and the weight from the pandemic didn't come in like you thought it was. So now if you're the hospital administrator, you check this one little box, COVID, your hospital gets another $38,000 to keep its staff in place.
Hmm.
And the talk show host who were playing the tape said, so if I check the box, I get an extra $38,000 to keep my hospital viable. Who's not going to check that box? And my heart just falls. If we don't have honesty and integrity,
right?
If everything is relative to, I need to check COVID, even if it's not COVID,
mm-hmm.
or even if they had COVID, but they got run over by a car and they died before they got to the hospital and they have COVID, they test positive COVID. I can check COVID.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm like, but that's not what the government set the money aside for. Mm-mm. But every other hospital is doing it. So we can't compete if we don't do it. And I just go, wow, once you go down that road of morality doesn't matter, that honesty and government's dumb enough to set up a program like that, we're actually encouraging people to be dishonest, to mm-hmm. keep themselves functional. I know it's one of the things we tried to avoid with you guys, particularly as you got older in your teenage years. I know you don't remember this incident because we've talked about this before, but you were wanting to go to a dance in a dress that Sarah didn't want you to go into. And it's your first dance, first school dance, and it was a dress more risque than Sarah wanted you to attend. Probably be conservative by today's standards, but
probably.
Yeah, probably not that big a deal. It wasn't hookerish or anything. And I remember you wanted to go in that dress, and it was like, and she wanted me to tell you not to, and I just said, go ahead. And after you left the room, she was like, why? And my thing is, I don't want to set you up to have to defraud me. The dress that you had could have fit in any purse, so you borrowed it from a friend. You can go to the dance. And if that's what you want to wear, your friend can bring you another dress and we'll never know. And I put you in a place where you would have to, where you could have deceived me and I would never have known. And yet you would have had this place in your life where you did something because you wanted to so badly. And I just told Sarah, I couldn't do it. I didn't want you. If that's the dress you wanted to wear, then wear it. And then we don't have to even think about whether you're going around my back somehow because I don't want to set you up for failure. And I think part of the way we teach morality is that there's consequences to decisions we make and mm-hmm. people get to do. And you make hard and fast rules that you know people are going to break, just like this COVID rule. You're going to make a rule that hospitals are going to break. And then if they don't break it, they're the stupid hospital.
Right. If you try to follow along and do the right thing, then you lose out.
That's what when I read Mark's letter, that's what I hurt for. I hurt for an honesty and an integrity that does what's right, does what's fair. For these black kids that scream when there's injustice, I need them to learn to do that. I need you not to just be quiet and go along. I need you to say, this isn't fair to us. Okay, why isn't it fair? What are we doing wrong? And we can learn from that. But I also think there's this moral, honest thing that makes society work. And if you don't have that, even in your relationships, if you come over to my house today and I ask you questions about how your life's going, you lie to me the whole time to make me feel good. If I ever find that out, I don't feel good.
Yep.
Something that just goes, yeah, you're going through the worst thing in your life, maybe. You're not today, thankfully. At least you haven't told me yet. But I don't get to know about it. Then why don't I get to know about it? Maybe I wouldn't be compassionate enough for you. And if that's true, I want to know that because I want to grow through that stuff. And honesty, integrity is the only thing that gives us progress and hope together. And it's not just, don't be a liar and follow the rule. It's not that. It's just the moral, even Sarah and my discussions. If I'm not being honest with her, and I mean gently honest, kindly honest, if there's mm-hmm. something I'm really hurting, but honest allows growth. And dishonesty keeps growth from me and it keeps growth from other people.
Yep.
But I talk too much. I know I do. And I thought we pretty much taught you all that stuff until you were driving you to college and you tell me about the night the cops are chasing you all over the golf course. Do you remember that?
No, I don't know what you're talking about.
It's just for illustrative
purposes.
We want
this on like recorded
this
evidence.
Is hilarious. Sarah and I drove along going, seriously, we thought our little daughter was just doing so good. And you weren't destructive. You didn't vandalize.
I didn't break anything. I didn't.
But you did mention some cops were driving around shining lights trying to find some of your friends that you may or may not have been with.
Maybe not.
Or maybe it never happened at all.
Maybe you're making stuff up.
So, Mark, yeah. I don't think this is where they're easy answers. This is why I love having Jesus in my life, because we didn't raise you kids with a plan. Mm-hmm. A curriculum. We just raised you guys to try and treat others like you want to be treated, try and be honest and kind and gracious in the world. And now the added thing of let's fight injustice. Let's really do it.
Yeah.
I don't mean let's loot stores and do that kind of thing. I just mean let's find a way to realize that particularly your kids, my kids that grew up in a white preferring culture can find a way to reach across and make it fair for everyone.
The kids and I have been reading through Mark this summer, or the past since coronavirus, that. And it's really been interesting to have those discussions and look at how does Jesus treat the people, treat these people, like with them. Like we'll read just a little bit at a time so we have a chance to let stuff sink in and let them really talk about it. And that's been a good dialogue to look at, you know, what can we learn from this on how to treat maybe somebody that maybe other people don't like how did Jesus treat him? And so it's been a great way to talk about, not this necessarily, but to just really look at how Jesus did, and that's what I think he asks us to do too.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.